Why don't we get started? My name is Ted Gerber, I'm director of CRECA, and before I introduce today's speaker, I just want to make a plug for our event next Thursday, which is not a sterile academic lecture, but instead a delightful, exciting musical concert. And I wish to invite everybody to come to see the Silk Road Ensemble, which is going to be at 7:30 p.m. in the Great Hall Memorial Union. And there's flyers around. And today's speaker, I'm delighted to say, is Peter Blitzstein, who's associate professor at Lawrence University. And I actually, he's a familiar face to me, or at least somewhat familiar, because 15 years ago? Well, we won't say how long ago. Some time ago, Peter and I were in a graduate seminar together, at least once, maybe twice.
At least once. I think twice,
And it was actually in political science, and he's a historian, I'm a sociologist, so you can probably imagine how much we love that seminar. His research focuses primarily on Imperial and Soviet Russian history, and his articles on Soviet culture and history have appeared in publications like Ab Imperio, Slavic Review, and Cahiers du Monde Russe. Oh, very impressive. He is currently at work on a book-length manuscript tentatively entitled Stalin's Nations, Soviet Nationality Policy Between Planning and Primordialism, 1936 to 1953. And today he's going to tell us about Imagining a Nation, the History of the USSR as a National Discourse, 1930s through 1950s. So please join me in welcoming Peter Blitzstein.
Thank you very much. Thanks to CRECA for inviting me, and also for the Department of History, especially Fran Hirsch and David McDonald. I'm really happy to be here. You look really familiar.
Yeah, John Bilgin.
We'll have to catch up later. Okay, so so for quite a long time, I've been struggling with the problems of Soviet identity and the idea of the Soviet Union or the USSR as a kind of national state or nationalizing state. This is something that practically everything I've written has addressed this problem. And in particular, what the relationship is or was between multi-ethnicity, cultural diversity in the Soviet Union, and Sovietness or Soviet unity. I title this paper Imagining a Soviet Nation, and I think of it as a kind of thought experiment rather than a kind of demonstration or proof. So I want to start with the idea that if we do see the Soviet Union as a kind of national state in the international arena, one that acts similarly to other national states, and this is something that I've argued elsewhere, then perhaps there was some kind of Soviet people that would match that state, that we could see what the Soviets referred to ideologically as Sovietsky Narod, as a kind of nation. Despite the fact, of course, that Stalin, and I'm focusing particularly here on the Stalin period, never defined it as such. The fact is that the idea of the Soviet people as a new kind of community emerges only in the Brezhnev or maybe late Khrushchev era. In the Stalin years, the phrase Soviet people, Sovietsky Narod, is never defined clearly. It's an ambiguous concept, open to various possible meanings. So if we open our minds to think of Sovietsky Narod as analogous to a nation, how might it be imagined? And then that's why this is kind of a thought experiment. I'm looking for imaginings. Well, we can, of course, go to Benedict Anderson's work on imagined communities. He writes this book. He wrote this book 25 years ago called Imagined Communities, and he argues that nations are imagined as sovereign and as limited and also as deeply historical communities. As he puts it, if nation states are widely conceded to be new and historical, the nations to which they give political expression always loom out of an immemorial past. They always are anchored in ancient traditions and in a long history. So perhaps what the Soviets refer to as Historia SSSR, history of the USSR, maybe that is the nation's history, the Soviet people's history. So I want to see the Soviet people as potentially a national project, one that is imagined historically, like most nations. And to do that, I'm going to do the imagining, but also hopefully my historical subjects will do some imagining too. I'm going to start with a short discussion of terminology, and then a longer discussion of this Historia SSSR, or History of the USSR, as a, we'll see, failed national project. Now, the current scholarly consensus is that the Stalin regime never intended to build, construct, or even imagine a Soviet nation. And this is notwithstanding the impact of what we might call constructivist approaches to the study of nationhood on the historiography of the USSR in recent years. As Kerry Martin puts it in what is now, in many respects, the locus classicus for policy in the 20s and 30s, the Soviet Union was not a nation state. This is a quotation. The Soviet Union was not a nation state, nor was its leadership ever committed to turning it into a nation state. No attempt was made to forge a new Soviet nationality. And similarly, Yuri Slyoskin, if I may take his name in vain, writes in his famous USSR as a Communal Apartment article that, quote, the Russians were not the only non-nation in the Soviet Union. The Soviets were not a nation either, unquote. Now, we can argue whether the Russians were a nation. That definitely is something that the historiography has often debated. But again, I think that I haven't seen anyone say that the Soviets were a nation. Now, these observations that I've just cited from Martin and Slyoskin fit, of course, with the more recent notion that the Soviet Union was an imperial state or some kind of empire community, one that I've also strenuously contested. Okay. One of the reasons, I think, for this scholarly resistance to seeing the Soviets as a nation is that in Soviet official discourse, nation, natsiya is the Russian word that was used, had a very specific meaning, one that was associated principally with ethnic communities at a particular level of historical development. Right? They were capitalist, and ultimately Stalin's, one of his principal innovations was to borrow from the Austro-Marxists to argue that nations could also exist at the socialist phase of history. Insofar as the Soviet community was not an ethnic community, therefore, ipso facto, there cannot be a Sovietskaya Natsiya, right? A Soviet nation. On the other hand, there is a word that was used frequently in Soviet discourse that was much more flexible and ambiguous, and that word is Narod, the people, or people. This word was flexible, labile even. It could be used to describe, as I've mentioned, the Soviet political community, as in Sovietsky Narod, as well as ethnic communities frequently, Kazakhsky Narod, Tajiksky Narod, Ruski Narod. It also was used in colloquial speech to indicate the common people. This was, goes back to the 19th century, right? Narod versus obshestva, people versus society. And it was also used in the plural form, narodi, to describe communities of varying size, culture, social, economic, and historical development. So I want to play with this idea that maybe narod is so flexible that when they said Sovietsky narod, they were imagining something that kind of looks like a nation, even though the rigid interpretation of nation coming out of Soviet discourse would argue against that. And it is in fact the case, I found it in the archive, that ordinary Soviet citizens did not fully grasp the distinction between narod and natsiya. A distinction that was ambiguous even to the ideologues who were supposed to clarify it. As one captain in the Black Sea Fleet wrote to Stalin himself, are the two words natsiya and narod synonyms? And if they are, then why do they say the Soviet narod? He further requested a definition of the word narod as, quote, an historical materialist category, unquote. And that, of course, was something the regime could not provide. It was too flexible a term. Indeed, the very number of nations remained unclear in the Soviet Union at this time, also something that shouldn't have been the case if Nazia fully worked for us here. Stalin, of course, had declared quite firmly in 1936 that there were about 60 nations in the Soviet Union. And as Fran Hirsch has shown, this led to serious consternation among ethnographers in 1939 when they were drafting the census because they thought there might be more or less. This firm decision by Stalin that there were about 60 meant that, obviously, that ideologues couldn't change or fit the concept to other communities, perhaps even to the Soviet people. In 1950, in April, several Soviet citizens had written into the Central Committee asking for clarification as to how many nations there were in the Soviet Union, and the response by the official ideologues was that Stalin had said in 1936 there were about 60, and we don't have more recent data, unquote. That was in April 1950. Okay. So as noted, of course, the terminological slippage between Narod and Nazia did not escape the notice of ordinary people who sought clarifications. And it tended to these questions often clustered around which groups counted as nations and which groups didn't count as nations. People wrote letters in, they wrote to Stalin, and they wrote to the Central Committee. And I'll just give a few more examples of people writing, particularly about Jews. The establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 reopened the question of Jewish nationhood, at least for interested Soviet citizens. Stalin, of course, in 1913 had argued that the Jews were not a nation. Right, and his famous definition of nationhood, which included territory, economy, psychological, cultural makeup, egad, language, and one more thing I can't remember.
Place in history.
Sense of history, okay. Of course, Jews may have had history, but they had no common language, they had no common economy, and they had no territory. Therefore, they couldn't count. Some have said, of course, that Stalin's definition was designed to exclude them. At any rate, in 1949, in March, an Israeli communist wrote to Stalin directly, asking about this question. After all, one of the obstacles to Jewish nationhood had been overcome. The State of Israel had been created. Did this mean that Jews could now be a nation? The Soviet Union had, after all, been the first to recognize the new state. By acknowledging the State of Israel, are the Jews living in it acknowledged as a nation, he asked. Now, of course, Stalin did not answer. But a similar inquiry sent to the journal Bolshevik got the following response from an official ideologue, a guy named Samarian. Jews, he said, had been a nation in Palestine even before the establishment of the Israeli state, though a bourgeois nation. That was his official answer. Two other letters came in to the Central Committee in 1949-1951 from a Red Army major who reported a dispute among officers studying Stalin's Marxism and the National Question. Some asserted that Jews in Israel were a nation. Others pointed to the lack of common language and common culture, because after all, Jews were coming from all over the world. Some thought that the Jews in Birobidzhan, the few who were there in the Far East, constituted a socialist nation, while others denied it. A party lecturer from Smolensk reported similar debates. This time, a different consultant at the Central Committee gave a different answer than Samarian had given. All Jews were still too dispersed and different to be a nation. Jews in Israel might become a bourgeois nation. Jews in Birobidzhan might become a socialist nation. But since Jews were assimilating, there were contradictory processes at hand. Jews were assimilating, of course, to Russians and whatnot. Now, this question of assimilation, if there's not a Jewish nation, what are Jews assimilating to, also was raised. As one Jewish engineer wrote to Stalin, he was complaining about anti-Semitism, of course, "I'm a Jew, but only because it was so written in documents when I was born. And though it might not conform to official understandings, for him, Soviet peoplehood, or perhaps Soviet nationhood, was the key marker of his identity. I always want to answer the questions about my nationality that, quote," and this is a direct quote, "I'm," and he put this in big letters, "Soviet by nationality," or "Soviet po nationalnosti," maybe, or "Sovietsky po nationalnosti," I think was what he wrote. Totally, which again, is a nonsense word, right, to the regime. Like, you can't be Soviet but not say Nalinisti. This makes no sense. But someone thinks they can. Okay. Another Jew wrote to Stalin pointedly asking whether one could change one's nationality, noting that the practice of denoting nationality in documents according to parentage contradicted Stalin's own definition of nation, of course, and which emphasized language, culture, economy, and territory, and not biology. Right. Okay. So that's the first, perhaps, unsatisfactory part of my talk. I don't think it proves anything except that there is this ambiguity about what nationhood could be in the Soviet Union, that it is conceivable to that people could imagine a Soviet nation. And people weren't sure what nation was, and they certainly weren't sure as sure as contemporary historians are that Nazia and nation are the only kind of nation, right, in Soviet discourse. And so, therefore, the first obstacle that has to be overcome if we're going to imagine the Soviet people as a nation is that there's at least a word that we can use. Narod, I think, is potentially such a word. And, of course, the next step is to see if anyone imagined it as such at the time. Here I may be also on shaky ground, but I'm going to forge ahead. I'm going to say that some people indeed did, not just these people who wrote in wondering whether they could be part of a Soviet nationalist or something, but actual historians and ideologues who sought to construct the history of the USSR. They also were trying to imagine a Soviet nation. They didn't use the word Sovietskaya Nazia, but they did talk, of course, about Sovietsky Narod. Historians, have recently really examined this effort by the regime, starting in the 1930s, to legitimate itself based on historical discourse. And this, in particular, there's been an emphasis on the regime's interest in providing facts and heroes and events that Soviet citizens could grasp onto for loyalty, for patriotism. This is David Brandenburger's book, National Bolshevism, is the touchstone for this. So, I'm not as interested in that. I'm interested instead in the way that Soviet historians narrated something, the way they told a story about the formation of a community or communities. Right? I think that's just as important for us to, if we're going to look at this rehabilitation of history. And I'm going to talk about three, or maybe two, depending on the time, moments, three episodes in the efforts by historians and ideologues to imagine a Soviet nation historically. These include the writing of school textbooks on the history of the USSR, which took place in the mid to late 1930s. Then a second episode in 1944, in the spring and summer, there was a conference of historians about major questions of historical interpretation of the USSR that had been raised because of disputes, particularly among the history of Kazakhstan. And the third episode, which I might not get to, unfortunately, is the post-war campaign against cosmopolitanism and bourgeois nationalism in the late 1940s. In each of these cases, historians and ideologues debated basic questions of historical interpretation in an effort, I would say, and I'm not saying this in a realist sense, like I'm not saying that they necessarily would have said that they were doing this, but I think that's what they were doing. Imagined a Soviet, what it meant to be Soviet in long-term historical context. Imagined how the Soviet peoplehood, in a national sense, where it came from. And I will also contend, unfortunately, because I would like to be able to contend otherwise, that in each case they failed to imagine, or their imagination perhaps was too restrained or constricted because of tensions within Soviet discourse. Okay, so first episode. This is the development of the Historia SSSR, History of the USSR. When I first heard about this, I think maybe in the Soviet period, it was very common. Like, that's what it was called in the Soviet Union as a discipline. Historia SSSR. There was a journal, and yet this Historia SSSR went way back into ancient times practically, and it kind of made no sense really. And now maybe now that the Soviet Union is no longer, we can sort of ask ourselves, like, how could it be possible to have a textbook on the Historia as a state that begins with ancient Armenia? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. This discourse was intended, this discourse of history of the USSR was intended to provide a basis for historical continuity, right, between ancient Rus, the Russian Empire, and the Soviet Union, and to explain how the Soviet people came into being. And the document that introduced this concept was a 1934 Central Committee decree, a very famous one, which ordered schools to teach, quote, a civic history, гражданская история, emphasizing key events, facts, and people in chronological form. Shortly thereafter, Stalin further clarified this formula. He demanded a history textbook, really for third graders and fourth graders, where, quote, the history of Russia, Velika Russia, is the word he used, is not torn away from the history of the other peoples of the USSR. Now, ultimately, the linchpin of this approach, where the history of Russia wasn't torn away, became the dogma of Druzhba Narodov, the friendship of peoples. The alliance between the Russian people and their most democratic and revolutionary elements, as the phrase was used, with the oppressed masses in the non-Russian borderlands was, in effect, the Soviet people in embryo. In other words, as the different peoples came together, they were forming the Soviet people. And this was to be traced as far back into the past as possible. But the thing is that Stalin's comments made it clear that this Historia SSSR would rely on ethnically defined narodi, peoples, niruskiye narodi, right, was the word that they would use, non-Russian peoples, as its principal actors. So despite the civic moniker, the actors in the story would be ethnic groups. And this fact, this is the fact that would seriously complicate efforts to develop a historical narrative about the origins and development of the Sovietsky Narod. And indeed, although Stalin's instructions directed historians to include the histories of all Soviet Narodi into an overarching history of the USSR, they made minimal headway in that direction. Stalin rejected initial textbook drafts as being little more than Russian history. The jury in the competition for the best grade school USSR history text in 1937 cited as a, quote, major accomplishment the fact that the competing variants had, quote, ceased to be the history of just the great Russian people, unquote. But at the same time, it lamented that none of the authors had solved, quote, the main task of also introducing as subjects of history the peoples enslaved by the Tsarist monarchy and liberated from national oppression by the great socialist revolution, unquote. It declined to award first prize, but awarded A.V. Shostakov's text a second prize, which was authorized for use in all USSR schools. If you look at Shostakov's book and also at some other texts from this era, Shostakov's book was for the third and fourth grade, and then Anna Pankratova, an academician at the Academy of Sciences at the Institute of History, she led a team that produced a book for the seventh and eighth, or for the eighth and ninth grade. There were also university textbooks as well, and textbooks for adult schools. All of them told the history of the USSR such that there was the history of Russians, or at least of the Russian state, and then surrounding it, there was what came to be referred to as Historia Neruskikh Narodov, history of the non-Russian peoples. They did not integrate the narratives of the non-Russian peoples into that broader Russian narrative. They had failed to follow through on the premise of an integrated history of the Soviet people, at least so far, from earliest times. That was the phrase that was always used, from earliest times, древнейших времен. And any sort of classic Soviet history text always started at the beginning. Okay. So the main theoretical innovation of this era, it's well known, it was called the Lesser Evil Doctrine. So what these textbooks, the way they tried to link the non-Russian histories, or the non-Russian people's histories, into a broader narrative was through the quote-unquote Lesser Evil Doctrine. And this was, in fact, first publicly described in that 1937 jury decision for textbook competition. According to this lesser evil doctrine, the Russian annexation of Georgia and Ukraine was ultimately a lesser evil. This is a well-known statement, ideological statement, was a lesser evil than the only alternative, which was conquest by backward neighboring states, such as Poland, the Ottoman Empire, or Persia. The latter, along this line of thinking of a lesser evil doctrine, would have retarded the economic development of the regions concerned, and therefore would have retarded the class formation, and would have made it harder to have a revolution, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So although the first edition of Shestakov's text didn't refer to the annexation or the union of Georgia and Ukraine with Russia as lesser evils, but it referred to them as unions, whereas other peoples were still referred to as having been conquered by the Tsarist Russia. His text in later editions did in fact use this term lesser evil, but whether to extend that concept to other peoples remained controversial. I'm going to talk about that next. So far, what links the peoples together is this lesser evil of Russian annexation as being less troublesome for them, for their progress, for their future, than that of neighboring states. So now I'm going to talk a bit about a second episode of efforts to imagine a Soviet people historically. And that's during the Second World War. So the promotion of traditional Russian symbols and heroes began in the late 1930s, as a number of historians have pointed out. And the advent of war accelerated this glorification of particularly Russian heroes. The regime mobilized historians to support the war effort by giving lectures and writing pamphlets. And at the same time, the war made the question of the interpretation of history especially thorny, because victory was a kind of crucial test for the regime itself, which buttressed its post-war legitimacy. Official ideology did not clarify what sort of community, what sort of historically developed community was responsible for that victory, which and what kind of narodi were responsible for that victory. It's in fact the case that Stalin is himself to blame for this, as he often was with ideological statements that contradicted one another. So for example, speaking on November 6, 1944, very famously, 27th anniversary of the October Revolution, he credited the Soviet order and Soviet patriotism with victory. And he emphasized this, the multi-ethnic character of Soviet patriotism. We could think of this as a multi-ethnic nation, a Soviet nation. The strength of Soviet patriotism, he insisted, consists in the fact that it is not based on racial or nationalistic prejudice, but on the people's deep loyalty and devotion to its Soviet motherland, on the brotherly cooperation of the toilers of all the nations, Nazi, of our country. All ethnic traditions, nationalne tradicije, and collective vital interests of all the toilers of the Soviet Union are harmoniously combined in Soviet history. So that sort of, that's an end of quote. In September of 1944, he's saying that the Soviet people, which is a genuinely multi-ethnic community, is with varied ethnic traditions, right, which is patriotic, is responsible for victory, right, is the community that is victorious, maybe the nation that is victorious. However, less than a year later, he offered his famous toast to the leading Russian people, the trust of which, quote, turned out to be the decisive force which made the historic victory over fascism possible. That's partly a quote. Made the historic victory, unquote, over fascism possible. This, of course, was a statement that was released over, this statement was repeated over and over and over again as well, right? In this case, perhaps, it's the Russian people, the Ruski Narod, that is responsible for victory, and that is somehow, it has this special place. And if it has this special place, what does that tell us about the possibility for a Soviet nation that is multi-ethnic but not chauvinistic or whatnot. Unclear. Historians and ideologues continue to struggle over how to reconcile these two demands, these two emerging demands. And I will skip. Professional historians in particular found it difficult to reconcile those two approaches. And fought incessantly during the war about them. So we can start with the controversial statement in 1944 by Yevgeny Tarlev, who was trained in the pre-revolutionary period as a diplomatic historian and suffered repression in the early 30s and then was rehabilitated, as were many, those who were still alive in the late 30s. He defended the imperial expansion of Tsarist Russia by noting, quote, "If now we are beginning to be victorious over that vicious enemy which attacked us, then one of the factors in this victory is our huge territory. That is now a factor that is saving us," unquote. He condemned a tendency to treat that expansion, which involves the conquest or the incorporation or the annexation or the lesser evil of these neighboring peoples, as if it were, quote, "barbarians' raids on other states," unquote. And he specifically referred to the official treatment at the time of the 19th century Caucasus rebel leader Shamil, who at the time was valorized officially as a hero of the Caucasus peoples in their struggle against Tsarist imperialism. Tarla admitted the need, quote, "to give a patriotic upsurge its due," unquote, but also insisted that, quote, "from the standpoint of the present, it was more important to emphasize that the Caucasian tribes today live under the Stalin constitution and not Shamil's theocracy," unquote. Other historians voiced Russian nationalism, even if they were themselves not Russian nationalists, even more openly. In the same year, 1944, at a history textbook conference at the Narkompros, that's the People's Commissariat of Education, the historian Alexander Yakovlev declared the importance of placing, quote, "the theme of Russian nationalism above all others. We respect the peoples, narodnosti, not narodi," right, which could be nations, maybe, but narodnosti, which implies remnants of people, little peoples, right, who have entered our union very much. We love them. "But it was the Russian people who made Russian history. We Russians want the history of the Russian people, of Russian institutions, and Russian conditions. Not Historia SSSR, right? But Historia Russia, which does not exist in the Soviet Union, right? And to rejoice in the fact that Kyrgyz slaughtered Russians at some point, or that Shamil managed to resist Nicholas I is inappropriate in a textbook," unquote. Ironically, Yakovlev was Chuvash, and Tarla, of course, was Jewish, but, you know, officially, according to Soviet identity. Not that as we know, passport nationality maybe doesn't really mean that you belong to a given nation. Maybe they really thought of themselves as members of the Russian nation. More ambiguity. Okay. What really outraged Yakovlev and Tarla was the publication of the first edition of the History of the Kazakh SSSR in 1943. Historia Kazakhskoy SSR. The controversy over this book led to a conference of leading historians held at the Central Committee Apparatus offices in May, June, and July 1944, triggered by incessant complaints, I might add, of Anna Pankratova. She was one of the co-editors of this book. Several historians, including Yakovlev, had described it as an outright anti-Russian book. And she, in general, was concerned, disturbed about what she saw as the rehabilitation of the Tsarist regime and of Russian nationalism and the denigration of the history of the non-Russian peoples. And she was supported by a number of historians at this conference, including Nikolai Rubinstein, who had written a book on historiography, Sidorov, who was the head of the Institute of History, Milica Nechkina, they all sort of supported her fear that that other historians were idealizing the Tsarist past, the Russian past, and making it impossible to imagine the kind of egalitarian Soviet unity that they thought Stalin wanted. Other historians, and examples here, were Isaac Mintz and Yefimov, I don't know his first name, Ave Yefimov, disagreed with Pankratova and felt, well, to quote the anthropologist Sergei Tolstov, every people must know its heroes, but that one mustn't lump them all together. Some fought against feudal exploitation, others fought against Russians. And here, in particular, the debate was about this Khan, this Kazakh Khan of the 1830s and 1840s, Kenesari, who fought, who struggled against the Tsarist state for a good 10 to 15 years before his territories were incorporated into the Russian Empire. And what the what historians like Yefimov and Mintz wanted was to explain that incorporation as a lesser evil. What Pankratova wanted, she didn't want to explain it as a lesser evil because that would have undermined what they saw as their goal. They linked nationhood with history, as they put it. Every people, narod, with a rich past must have its own written history. The progressive path of development of that people is represented in such a history, which helps the growth of the self-consciousness of the people. This is a classic nationalist historical narrative, right? The production of the history of the Kazakh SSSR in the conditions of the Great Patriotic War, they added, helps the process of educating the Kazakh people, narod, in the spirit of the heroic traditions of its past struggles, and in the spirit of Soviet patriotism, which is especially important for the struggle against the German fascist occupiers, unquote. And in particular, they rejected what they call the tendency to deny the progressive role of state formation on Kazakh territory and to represent all Kazakh khans or leaders merely as exploiters without determining the historical significance of each of them individually. And in this context, they argued that this Khan Kenesari in the 1830s, quote, wanted to found a united Kazakh khanate, or you know, state, on a feudal basis, free of colonial dependence, and that would have been, quote, a huge step forward in the history of the Kazakh people, or narod. However, if indeed the foundation of a Kazakh state free of colonial dependence would have been a progressive step, it's kind of hard to see how it could be seen as contributing to the long-term emergence of the Soviet people as a nation. That is, historians had to choose between the lesser evil of colonial annexation and the greater good, my words, of national independence under a feudal ruler. Everyone wanted to inculcate Kazakh youth in the spirit of their traditions. Of course, the question was which traditions went in the right direction historically. Again, the lability of the word narod is key here. On one side, you have people who see the narod as Kazakhs and who are trying to write a history that explains the emergence of the Kazakh narod. On the other hand, you have people who have a goal of seeing a Soviet people emerge, which means that the Kazakhs can't be fighting Russians, right? In a good way, they can't be fighting Russians. And indeed, this conference itself led to nothing. There was lots of arguing, but no firm conclusion was drawn about how much to condemn Tsarist colonialism, how much to valorize it as the basis of a future Soviet people. One thing that was clear, though, was that this Kazakh history had to be condemned, and so it was. And what's interesting is to look at how the Kazakh party leadership, which had been a sponsor of this text and was therefore really, really shaken up by its condemnation, how they described what a second edition of the text should be like. This is what they wrote. Quote, "It is necessary to take into account that the union of Kazakhstan with Russia did not exclude, but on the contrary, enabled the development of the national liberation movement of Kazakhs against the autocracy, and that the leading democratic and revolutionary elements of the Russian people played a great positive role in this struggle." Unquote. Now, this is nothing new. I mean, anyone who's read this kind of stuff, and Lowell Tillett wrote a book about this years ago, but what I'm trying to do is say here that it's not just about propaganda or about twisting history, it's about creating stories that inculcate a sense of identity. Right? Maybe, or something. A sense of community. Okay. What that last quotation I just read was saying basically was the conquest of Kazakhstan by the Russian state made it possible for the Kazakhs to join the progressive Russians in resisting that state, to therefore create a people. And if you focused only on Kazakhs as a nation, or the Narod Kazakhs, you wouldn't get there. Okay, I have about 5 minutes left, maybe. So I'll...
Don't feel like you need to skip too much.
I won't skip too much. Okay. So what I'll just talk a little bit more about efforts to square the circle. So I mentioned that after this conference in 1944, in May and June and July, that nothing came of it. Stalin tasked Andrei Zhdanov, who had just been appointed, he was a secretary of the Central Committee, but he had just been given the brief of ideology and propaganda right around this time. He replaced Alexander Shcherbakov. And Zhdanov wrote these long, long theses about this, about history. They went on for 40, 50 pages. And it's actually interesting. There are about 15 or 16 different versions of these theses at the Communist Party, at the Erdogaspi, the Central Committee Archive in Moscow. And David Brandenburger and a Russian colleague, I think it was the Russian colleague, actually, but they went through every single one. And they have like charts and everything showing each version and every change that Zhdanov made and changes that Stalin asked him to make to these theses that went nowhere. They're interesting, nevertheless, to look at because they tell us what the regime was thinking at the time about how to square the circle. Okay, so what does Zhdanov do? Well, firstly, he condemns Yakovlev and Tarle for denying that Tsarist Russia was a prison of peoples and the gendarme of Europe. These were the phrases that were used. The gendarme of Europe and the prison of peoples. He detected, quote, the rebirth of a great power nationalist ideology in their work, and sided with Pankratova in condemning Tarle's idea, for example, that it was the size of Russia and not the Soviet system that was the basis for victory in World War II. He saw that they were emphasizing nationalism as the motive force and not friendship of peoples, and that's not good. He even compared Tsarist policies to those of Nazi Germany. And this, of course, you know, seems a little shifty, but we have to remember the context here. It was the middle of 1944. He defined Soviet patriotism as being patriotic, egalitarian, and contrasted it to nationalism and imperialism. At the same time, and cosmopolitanism, too. At the same time, he condemned Pankratova and the editors of this History of the Kazakh SSR in the following way. Any attempt to represent the fact of incorporation, that was the word that was increasingly used, not annexation, not conquest, but incorporation of Kazakhstan to Russia as an absolute evil, and to present the idea that Kazakhstan had the possibility of an independent state existence is a falsification of history, which benefits bourgeois nationalists. He ended by calling for a struggle, quote, on two fronts, which is a classic Stalinist discursive tactic. Struggle on two fronts. Now, as I mentioned, these theses remained unpublished, but their themes crept into public official discourse in 1944 and 1945. In its opening editorial, the new history journal Vaprosi Istoriyi, which began publication in 1945, condemned both petty bourgeois nationalism in works treating Kazakhstan and Tatarstan, but also great power chauvinism. And key statements in this period, key sort of statements in journals like Bolshevik, which was the official ideological journal, on Soviet patriotism in these years, tended to avoid the theme of Russocentric themes that might be seen as Russian nationalist, and focused more on Soviet internationalism and multi-ethnicity. In this, in the period 1946 to 48, it looked like authorities were moving towards a new synthesis, a way of integrating what amounted to, or creating, a history of the Soviet people that would be multi-ethnic, in which the different actors would be ethnic groups, and in which the Russian ethnic group would be the most important. And at the same time, in which all the peoples in it would be equal. That is, Soviet peoplehood would be independent of the ethnic identity of the member. And yet the Russians were the most important, but not the only ones who helped form it. This new synthesis would have involved the extension of the lesser evil doctrine beyond Georgia and Ukraine to Kazakhstan and elsewhere, would have pushed away categories of national liberation for any people, including the Russians, because, again, one of the problems of the Kazakh history text was the way in which it used the category of national liberation and the formation of a Kazakh state as the culmination of history in some respect. And it would include this sort of Russia as elder brother theme. However, Zhanov died. This is the problem that I'll admit I've had with this particular argument for a while now, which is, as Zhanov dies, he seems to be the one who is pushing this synthesis, and he is replaced by Suslov, who holds the position forever. 1948. This is 1948, and Suslov died in 1981 or something. So basically, he was, you know. And Suslov and his crew were responsible, let's just say, for the anti-cosmopolitan campaign, among other things. And obviously, there's now deep evidence that Stalin, of course, was responsible for all these campaigns. Suslov replaced all of Zhdanov's folks in the agitprop at the Central Committee, and they began to condemn cosmopolitanism in a variety of ways. And of course, as many of you probably know, the anti-cosmopolitan campaign was simultaneously a campaign that was of disguised anti-Semitism and a campaign of Russian nationalism. But it had kind of interesting consequences for non-Russian peoples. So long as they emphasized that they weren't cosmopolitans, they could begin to promote their independent national paths, their autochthonous development, their development that was completely independent of anyone else but Russians. And so, for example, this is the way of, I guess, we can understand the impact of this anti-cosmopolitan campaign on questions of non-Russian historical narratives. This comes from the introduction to the Anthology of the Literature of the Peoples of the USSR, edited by Lucian Klimovich, who was head of the Nationalities Commission of the Writers' Union. Now, the interesting thing about this anthology, which was only for the Central Asian peoples, is that it really reproduced ancient and early modern texts. It did not reproduce more recent texts. This is the way he described it. The literature of Azeris, Uzbeks, Turkmen, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Tajiks, each of these peoples individually, is full-blooded, original, and independent. Polnakrovy, samobytny I nezavisomy. Now, again, if this is a very nationalistic interpretation, right? That a national literature has no external influence, really, right? And this gives us the possibility of seeing how important ethnic nationhood is in Soviet discourse and how it could perhaps be an obstacle to the formation of a Soviet unity. Each of these literatures, he goes on to write, has their own independent samostoyatelny history, their historical path of development. The literature of the Russian people has an especially positive significance in the development of all these literatures. End of quote. So on the one hand, all these literatures are supposed to be completely independent. On the other hand, they're all supposed to be influenced by the Russians. It's telling, of course, that Klimovich's book was attacked for both insufficiently emphasizing the Russian contribution to these works, despite the fact that he insisted on it, that it was. It was also attacked for emphasizing that Tajik literature had Iranian origins, instead of that it was completely independent of Iran, but not of Russia. Okay. I need to sum up, but I want to say that paradoxically, the anti-cosmopolitan campaign, and actually there was an article in Russian Review not long ago about Uzbek music by Kirill Tomov that also echoes this idea. Paradoxically, the anti-cosmopolitan campaign reinforces the idea that ethnic groups are actors, that ethnic narodi are actors in history, which undermines the possibility of a history that would create a genuine Sovietsky narod, and that made it difficult, if not impossible, to imagine Sovietsky narod. Okay. My conclusion. I have tried to demonstrate that from the beginning, although there might have been words we could use, like narod, to imagine or describe a Soviet community as a nation, that efforts to imagine that nation were unstable and suffused with tensions that were unresolvable. And this, rather than, for example, an effort to emphasize the positive results of Russian empire building or imperial discourse, is the problem. Let me say that again, because that wasn't clear. Traditionally, when people have looked at the history at this subject, the Historia SSSR, and the history of the various non-Russian peoples, they have said that what the regime was trying to do was emphasize the positive results of empire building. And they have also said that, or more recently, Serhiy Yakelchik in his book on Ukraine has talked about Historia SSSR as being an imperial discourse. And that is the reason why we get these very incomplete histories of the non-Russian peoples. I guess what I would say is the reason why we get these incomplete histories of the non-Russian peoples is because of the effort to tell the history of ethnic groups, because of the centrality of that concept within the larger historical scheme. The problem was that two kinds of people were supposed to achieve their destiny in Historia SSSR: the Soviet people as a whole and the individual peoples which composed it. And the individual peoples which composed it were ethnic, and what the Soviet people were was never really allowed to emerge because of that. Nations, being limited and sovereign, could not contain other nations. The Soviet people couldn't also contain the Russian people, the Kazakh people, if we understand them all as nations. In that respect, discursively, Soviet peoplehood and ethnic peoplehood, whether it be Kazakh or Russian, were incompatible. Of course, whether narodi could contain other narodi was an unanswered question and would remain, I think, unanswered up until the end of the Soviet era. That's all I've got. Thanks.
Did the term inorodtsi play any role in those debates you're describing?
No, because inorodtsi or inorodets was discursively persona non grata in these debates. You can't refer to. You weren't supposed to refer to them as inorodtsi in official discourse at this time. It was seen as being demeaning. So that was seen as being a czarist holdover. So they would refer to nationalnosti for smaller peoples, or narodnosti more often, or nationalnie grupy, but not narodzi. Yeah.
How do you sort of reconcile an argument about maybe the continuity of national policy or policy of nationalities when when World War II is such an event, right, that clearly steers things a different direction? And whenever you're in such an imperialist kind of war, you're going to reach back in history and pull out the Alexander Nevsky stories, and you're going to, you know, you're going to create a kind of history that's specifically defined by the fact that you're in a war. And so for me, I wonder about the continuity there. You know, like it would be almost more interesting to study pre-World War II, you know, pre-39, 38, you know, policies and how that was developing, to really talk about what the Soviet idea of nationality was and how that was supposed to go in terms of an ideological argument. I think that World War II really shakes things up in such a way that I'm not sure you can draw a linear relationship there. I mean, look at nationality in the United States, even during World War II, things change, you know.
Obviously things change. I think, well, I don't think, I think, I'll make a provocative statement. I think that the war merely, and I emphasize merely just to be provocative, reinforced ideological and discursive developments that had been in play since the early 30s. I think that David Brandenberger's book, National Bolshevism, really proves this, that the Nevskys, the Ivan the Terribles, the Minin and Pozharskys are rehabilitated long before the war. Russian history is rehabilitated long before the war. That's what the problem with this Shestakov text is in the late 30s. They're trying to create a text that has Ivan the Terrible as a good guy, but that also isn't like a, you know, Russian nationalist text. So what I think happens in the war is that the regime, it just fastens on, reinforces these earlier trends. And also begins to, or continues to, I didn't really mention this in much detail, but begins to also promote the valorization of non-Russian heroes. And that's where the problem develops, because they're not compatible. And maybe that's less of a problem in 1935 when you're just talking about what you're going to teach kids in school, and more of a problem during war when you need to be really careful what you're telling people they're fighting for. And for there, I would say yes, that the war plays a role. But in terms of the, you know, what some people have referred to as the rehabilitation of Russian national heroes or Russocentrism, the war is really not that important. It's not the beginning. And I think, again, I think David Brandenberger's book demonstrates that. Ted?
So, two questions. So first, at the your concluding statement, I mean, you draw a lot of attention to the sort of inherent contradiction in this project of creating a Soviet nationality or a sense of identity when you have, you know, basically a collection of ethnicities or nationalnosti. And I mean, while I certainly agree that it is an inherent contradiction and probably in many ways impossible, it seems that it's not just that there are these different ethnicities, it's that they all have histories, many of which involve long struggles and hatreds for one another and fighting. And so it's not just that there is this collection of ethnicities, it's that, you know, they haven't always gotten along so well. And and you can't just ignore that.
You can't?
If you want to make, you know, the Kazakh feel good about Shamil or the Azeris or whoever, then the Russians are going to get angry, and you see a lot of this coming up. So, I mean, that's just sort of I'm sure you probably agree with that. So, but in your maybe you don't. But maybe that's a question I'm trying to get at. Like, you left the impression that there's a structural problem here with the fact there are these ethnicities, and I just wanted to push you a bit. So it's not just that there's different ethnicities, that they have these long histories of conflict and struggle.
I recognize maybe I didn't, I don't think I made, my, I think my conclusion, maybe I didn't really make my argument as clear. And it goes back to why I want to imagine the Soviet Narod as a nation. So I want to say that first, and then I'll address something else you said. I think, pardon me, the discursive tension, maybe it's a contradiction. is that Soviet people is imagined as something like a nation, and all these other groups are imagined as something like a nation, and you simply can't imagine a nation within a nation. And that becomes the problem, I think.
Why not?
Because nations are, nations are imagined as limited and sovereign. You can talk about them as something else, but as a nation, no, you can't have a nation within a nation. I'll ask my question. Yeah. Now, I know that this is provocative. I'm just, So the other question, you said, well, they have these histories. History is not an objective field that's just there. History is crafted, right? History is created. History is imagined. So what the regime is trying to do is imagine histories for these peoples. And it, when it's doing that, it's making a conscious decision that the history that it's going to imagine for the Kazakhs is a history of a nation. It didn't have to do that. It did not. Yes, there were these Kazakhs that were fighting Russians. There's no question. People who, at the time, identified themselves as Kazakhs, fighting people who, at the time, identified themselves as Russians, whatever that meant to them. But there is no reason to imagine that the central part of the story as being of ethnic groups fighting, or even of nations coming into being. The regime decides that ethnic groups are going to be the actors. It does this for its own reasons, which I think Fran knows, and Terry, you both worked about this, right? They didn't have to do it that way. But nationality policy makes it impossible for them to do it another way. Is that making any sense?
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, it makes sense. But it also leads me to my second question, which not to...
No, please.
But and that is, can you, and this is a naive question, not especially, can you say more about the conditions of intellectual production that these historians were working under? I mean, you, in a way, listening to you, you can sort of imagine that these are just sort of, professional historians who have intellectual disagreements and maybe understand that there's some task given to them to be part of this national identity construction project. But really, this could be, the United States in the late 19th century, for all we understand from your talk. But we know that the Stalin system was very harsh on scholarly activities, and that with a mere change in ideological winds, people could lose their lives, and that there were people used political posturing to sell personal scores. It was a big unruly mess. And what is the on what basis can we really treat these historical texts as sort of disinterested attempts to provide these accounts, as opposed to attempts that may have been motivated by all kinds of other considerations?
If I gave the impression that they're disinterested, then I'm sorry, because they're not. They are interested, and well, there's no question that there is score settling going on. I didn't talk about it in the paper, but the people who want to valorize the Russian empire building are pre-revolutionary. Trained in the pre-revolutionary period, they were repressed in the early 30s. Those who survive come back and they're rehabilitated. And the people who are, like Pankratova, who are valorizing the Kazakh nation, are people who study with Pokrovsky in the late 20s and early 30s, and who's also been denounced, and who were responsible for that. So there's no question they hate each other. They hate each other. And there's no question either that they know that there's political struggle going on here, and that they could all be, that some of them could be sent off to the gulag. And despite that fact, if you read the transcripts of these debates, people are genuinely arguing about what happened. They have alternative points of view, and we need to take those into account too. And what's interesting, this is something that I found to be interesting about a range of these kinds of meetings in the 1940s. People are, maybe afraid, but they're actually debating real stuff. They're not just mouthing propaganda, right? And they have to talk in a certain way, but they, I don't want to say it's the same kind of debate that, Fran and I might have in 5 minutes about whether nations can contain nations, because one of us might not end up alive, but it's, or something, but it's not just, it's real. It's real. And as far as whether these are like good historians or bad historians, I mean, that's another question, but all of them, you know, produce significant work based on primary sources. All of them, you know, are also constrained significantly by ideology, which I don't want to say they believed in, because I'm not sure the category of belief fits here, but that they certainly, that wasn't merely, they weren't just merely parents.
Yes, yeah, so just to follow up on this, some other questions maybe for later. But I guess, based on Soviet ideology, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding what's at stake for you in this argument about the Soviet nation, right? Based on Soviet ideology, there were these Nazi anomalies, and at the same time as there was a Sovietsky Narod, and there was this idea that at some point in the far-off future, right, the nations would disappear and lead to this, you know, merge together into the Soviet people, right? And that's how that's the ideology from the 30s, and by the time you get to the 46, 47, into the 50s and 60s, and I don't know how long you're taking this story forward, but in the 60s, Soviet sociologists are actually getting together at these congresses, right, to discuss Sovietsky Narod, you know, and what exactly is it, and what is the process by which these nationalities and nations are merging and are continuing to merge into this Soviet nation. Now, whether we call that nation a nationality in the sense that we understand nationality or not, again, I don't understand what's at stake for us as scholars in doing that. For the later period, what's at stake for the people in the 50s and 60s, in part, is it's this contrast with America. Because by then, that's what they're looking at. It's the middle of the Cold War, and when they're talking about the idea of a Soviet nation, they're thinking of it in parallel terms to this idea of an American nation. And so in terms of Cold War competition, it's, yes, there's a Sovietsky Narod that's comparable to, you know, the American nation, and the Soviet one is better, right? So that's kind of, that's the stakes for them in the 50s and 60s. I guess I'm not sure what the stakes are for you in making the argument, and what's at stake for the scholars, other than trying to fight for their lives, right, in this period of the 30s and 40s.
Okay. Let's say for the scholars, start. There's immense evidence that they really cared about this stuff, ideologically speaking. Reggie Zelnick, his last book was about Pankratova, and he demonstrates how important it is for her to fight against this, what she thinks of as a kind of Russian chauvinistic rehabilitation that's going on under Stalin. So these ideological disputes matter to them. That's what's at stake. Now, I want to start by saying I think it's really important, and this is one of the points I'm making, that we don't go into the 50s and 60s and 70s, because that we look at the Stalin period distinctively for a moment, just like shut off the other stuff for a second, because in the Stalin period, Sovietsky Narod was much more ambiguous as a term than it was later, when Bromley says, you know, that there's going to be this merging, and they don't ever define Sovietsky Narod as a nation, but they definitely talk about it much more clearly. They don't do that in the Stalin period, and I don't think we should assume that things had to go in the direction they went. So if we skip to the 50s and 60s, we're going to have this certain assumptions about what Sovietsky Narod meant, and when they say specifically that it's not a nation, and not be able to see what's going on in the Stalin period. So I want to shut out what happens later. Now, what's at stake for me otherwise? Well, because I firmly believe that Soviet and ethnic are not compatible. And that's what I'm trying to show, that the effort to discursively produce Soviet subjects and ethnic subjects at the same time in the 40s and early 50s is creates all kinds of tensions and paradoxes. And so what I've tried to do here, and admittedly it's, you know, it's rough, is to show this on the discursive level, to say that ways of talking about Sovietness and non-Russianness in a historical sense are incompatible. And I will also show this in other ways in practice in other chapters of my forthcoming book. And I know that you've shown this idea of double assimilation, right? And I'm not saying that is wrong for the time period you looked at, but I think that there are tensions there that get more and more problematic in the 40s and early 50s. And so I want to be able to say that Soviet and non-Russian are no, sorry, Soviet and ethnic discourses of community can't be blended as easily as we might think, as easily as you maybe have argued before. So that's what's at stake.
What's at stake in that argument for you? I mean, is
me personally?
I mean,
I think it's an interesting
argument. Scholar in terms of understanding the Soviet Union.
I think that it, I mean, again, I think it reveals a incoherence in Stalin-era practices and discourses that is interesting. And I don't think I need to show any more. I mean, do I have to show that this leads to the collapse of the Soviet Union? I mean, why am I obligated to do that 40 years later? No. Seriously, I think it's interesting to show how completely incoherent the Stalin regime was in its practices and discourses, as opposed to what other historians might say is, you know, monolithic coherence.
Excuse me, may I add some observations? Congratulations to your discourse, I followed it with great interest. But what I miss here, what probably the criticism is aiming partly, is our clear benchmarks. The edges are blurred. I mean, a lot of people before you discussed the contradictions in Stalin theory. So I wonder, you mentioned later the name of Pokrovsky, which is very important, the demolition of his school. Would you say that this means that the traditional international, proletarian internationalism is based on the classics, Marx and Engels, especially their interpretation of Tsarist imperialism in 1848 in favor of the Poles, quite one-sided interpretation. I mean, there is no chance for the Russians to get out of this mess, you know, whatever costume they take, red or blue. So that is, the peak of it is Pokrovsky, the continuation, and he's demolished. That means there's no return to this. What comes after that? Where do you see the new trend? Is it the new Soviet patriotism? It's usually interpreted with this saving of the icebreaker Chelyuskin. And you see the change, how they interpret these superhuman achievements of, no, are these Russian patriots? Is Chkalov a Soviet man or a Russian man?
He's a Sovietsky Chelyuskin, yeah. But
is he all Russian?
I think, but
is he Ruski or
he's easy. These guys in the Chelyuskin's easy. The problem is what you do with the past, not what's happening then. I mean, Chelyuskin, Chkalov, these guys, those who survive don't get killed off in 1937.
You have to link the past with the,
yeah,
the future.
And the problem, what comes after Pokrovsky, I think traditionally the interpretation has been after Pokrovsky, we return to Kluchevsky. Right, sort of. We return to Russian national history. We don't. After Pokrovsky, we return to a cacophony of ethnic histories that can't be reconciled. And the regime keeps calling for Historia SSSR as this united narrative, as this integrated narrative, which I think of a Soviet nation, and it can't get it because it's also calling for this cacophony of ethnic national narratives, where the principal actors are peoples, not classes. And Pokrovsky, you know, he didn't really write about national history. And in fact, he didn't write a lot about the non-Russians either, although some of his followers did, I guess. But yeah.
I like the general tenor of what you're trying to say, although I think I'm going to go the other way from Milan and say, why not be comfortable with the mess? That these contradictions don't have to be irreconcilable, or that what's interesting, well, several things, anecdotally, by the way, just to add to the mess, Tarlov wasn't simply rehabilitated, he was rehabilitated personally by Stalin and enjoyed his personal protection. I don't know if you've read Raphael Benyelin's memoirs, but they're brilliant on this stuff. And Tarlov, going, he had his own personal access to the Akademichka and Peter in Leningrad, got to read all the forbidden collections, got to say what he wanted at speeches and that. And Tarlov, of course, wasn't just a diplomatic historian. He'd written a historic history of the Great Northern War, Peter Against the Swedes, which is where he gets this idea of space. And he that was supposed to be writing a war, a history of the Great War of the Fatherland, 1812, mm-hmm. and he had a commission to write one on the Soviets. So, A, he's protected. So Zhdanov can write anything he wants about Tarla. It ain't going to go anywhere. Okay. B, Tarla's a Petersburg or a Leningrader, and they're the ones, all the rest of them take it in the neck. In that it's 47, the Zhdanov shit, that's the Leningrad affair. That's not general Soviet historiography. The Muscovites, Pankratova, Mintz, and that get off pretty scot-free, not Rubinstein. But the more interesting part, if I were going to go to the Soviet Union, look at the Soviet Union 44 to 47 from the point of view of some sort of Sovetskaya Narodnost, I would say there, you see imaginings of it. Iconology of the Red Army. It's a Soviet flag that's winning. It's not a Russian flag. It's party congresses and Central Committee plena, where you see all the party members in their ethnic dress showing the compatibility and females and people from Narodnosti to Nazionalnosti to Nazi, who show that there is no incompatibility between being a Sovietskiy Grazhdanin and fully conscious. Like, there's the embryo, I would say, if you're, because they do, I think you're right, these people do look historically, developmentally, and teleologically, and there they're imagining the appearance of a Soviet nationality. Two areas where, or three areas where we tend not to look because we don't take them seriously as experiential dimension for the everyday Soviet citizen. Soviet soccer teams taking part, you know, think of Bob Adelman's work on Soviet participation in the World Cup. Soviet team goes to the Olympics before Stalin dies.
52? 52.
Okay. And then, in Helsinki. And then the great export, you know, the from Shostakovich's seventh, right, the wartime broadcast, the export and the display of a Soviet aesthetic, right? So there are ways in which these are being imagined, and I think what's interesting in your paper is I think it shows incoherence much more than you're giving credit for. I think notions like Narod, they're deployed very differently in different contexts. Nazi, the same thing. You can't refer to a Soviet Nazi because it's historically above, mm-hmm. it's beyond the particularity that's implied by Nazi. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these people, these meetings in 44, summer 44, these people, what's interesting and ironic is they believe, and I think most of them do believe sincerely from their various points of view, that there is a way to reconcile these things. That we can say retrospectively they were incompatible. And right. The last thing, this is one of these typically long questions you hear at conferences. The history of the USSR is also the history of the development of a certain type of state. Mm-hmm. And the relationship of state to peoples is critical, especially when you build the party in after 1898 or 1902 or whenever you want to start. And does that show up in the discussions at all? That there are certain types of state that accompany certain developments, and is that a way that they try and get at? I know in the lesser evil discussions there's
right.
some of that.
Wow, okay.
That's the short version.
I like the idea of incoherence. I'm willing to just throw in as much incoherence as possible, because to me, incoherence is history. It's, mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I played that down too much. I don't know now what to say. The history of the state, do they, I think implicitly they could, it'd be easy if they were just talking about the formation of a state.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that they're also talking about the formation of people, of a people or peoples. And both of those need to be both developmental, into some kind of telos, and they have to match each other.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are these discursive boundaries, right? You cannot, you have to describe history in certain ways, you have to use terms in certain ways, other things are off limits. And what's interesting is that in that limited field, there is these tensions and incoherences, and they're produced by Stalin himself, in a way, because he wants Soviet unity, but he also wants all the peoples to have their own histories. It doesn't make, it doesn't, yeah. And to do another example, Stalin wants all Russian, all Soviet citizens to learn Russian perfectly, but he also wants every Soviet citizen to have their own language, right, and to be educated in their own language, and this causes tremendous problems too. So, yeah.
Last question.
Two quick questions.